This is the next installment in our series in Luke, and we're going to look at Luke 12, 49 to 59. And now Jesus has just finished commanding that we be ready at all times for his return, as his followers were to be awake and aware as we wait for him. Now he goes on to speak of dissension and opposition. "And I came to send fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. But I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how distressed I am until it's accomplished. Do you suppose I came to give peace on earth? I tell you, not at all, but rather division. For from now on, five in one house will be divided, three against two and two against three. Father will be divided against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Then he also said to the multitudes, whenever you see a cloud rising out of the west, immediately you say, a shower is coming. And so it is. And when you see the south wind blow, you say there will be hot weather. And there is. Hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky and of the earth, but how is it you do not discern this time? Yes, and why even of yourselves do you not judge what is right? When you go with your adversary to the magistrate, make every effort along the way to settle with him, lest he drag you to the judge deliver you to the officer, and the officer throw you in prison. I tell you, you shall not depart from there till you have paid the very last mite." He has promised to give peace to the believer, but not peace between the believer and the non-believer. Did you ever stop to wonder why a belief in God that teaches us to love all men, to love your neighbor as yourself, not lie, not steal, not bear false witness, or covet that which belongs to another, should attract such vitriolic opposition? Christians should be seen as ideal citizens, but increasingly they are not. And we see this in the reaction of the unsaved toward Christians, and increasingly in the actions of the government toward the church. By our very existence, we send a message. We do certain things, we abstain from other things, and by existing, we send a message. That message is rejected by the common culture. Although today we're not subject to the level of persecution that Rome used on the early church, or the persecution suffered by Christians today in the Middle East or Africa, China, or other Far East countries, it's clear that the government is often not favorably inclined toward the local church. And there are many forces which desire to move any and all mention of God from the public square and prohibit Christians from taking any action in living out their faith. Just as the Anglican Church prescribed doctrine and the pilgrims came to these shores to escape it, our government increasingly promotes a humanistic doctrine, and that includes excessive fines or being forced out of business for the person who will not comply. The relationship between saved and unsaved is compared here to a division, is compared here to kindling a fire. Even households will be divided. This is what he predicts for believers. He also says he has a baptism to undergo, which speaks to the cross. He was baptized by John in the Jordan River at the commencement of his ministry. And this other baptism will remark the culmination of his ministry. He will lay down his life. He will take it up again. But the crucifixion will take place because of the rejection of Jesus by the Jewish leadership. For they were the ones that brought Jesus before Pilate. Otherwise, the trial would never have happened. For why would Rome care about a teacher with no armed followers and no political ambition who walked from place to place teaching the people? Jesus was no political threat to Rome. He was no military threat to Rome. And aside from idle curiosity and some of their leaders wanting to see a miracle take place, it's doubtful that Rome would have paid any attention to him at all. But the Jewish leaders brought him to Pilate, and we see in Mark 15:10 that it's recorded that Pilate knew they delivered him out of envy. Envy means you're angry that another person is doing well. It also means you desire what they have. And so the chief priests, scribes, and Pharisees were envious. For they had challenged him many times. There was always a reply. Render to Caesar the things of Caesar and to God the things of God. Or the baptism of John, was it from man or from heaven? And he pinched them in places they couldn't get out of. They couldn't trap him in his words because he got the best of them. Now, the Middle East was and is, and I've said this before, a shame honor society. I don't think we really understand that well, but attaining honor was the pinnacle of success, the best you could do. And on the contrary, being shamed was absolutely the worst thing that could happen. People followed Jesus. They talked about him. He did things like feeding the multitude from one lunch, healing the sick, giving sight to the blind, raising Lazarus from the dead. Now, these things were not done in a corner, as was said elsewhere in the New Testament. There were many witnesses. Often the Pharisees were right there, some of them. And so, these things could not be denied. Jesus was gaining much honor from the crowds. You could see it from the shouts and the palm branches they were waving and the branches they laid down in the road when he came into Jerusalem. None of this escaped the notice of the chief priests and the Sanhedrin. And they feared that the people would come to believe in Jesus as the Messiah. In the culture of the time, they believed their status as religious leaders of the nation was being diminished by this wandering prophet and teacher, and they wanted the respect and admiration of the people for themselves. Jesus was gaining a great deal of respect and attention when they couldn't bring him down by argument, when they couldn't bring him down by the use of their religious authority. They turned to Rome to have him killed as a last resort. And so Jesus turns to the crowds and he rebukes them for spiritual dullness. Think of a teacher trying to get a class to learn. At a class one time, I called my dumb class. Not to them, just to myself. And you would explain something to them and they'd say, "We don't get it." "Well, what part don't you get?" "All of it." They absolutely would not engage their brains to think. They want to be spoon-fed. Now, correspondingly, I had a class I called my smart class, and they had a lesson every day that was scheduled. I could give them a lesson and a half. They could still do it. They were a delight. But I dreaded my other one. So now, listen to what he's saying here. Why can't you engage your brain and perceive what's right in front of you and understand what you're seeing? You look at the clouds or feel the wind. You see a cloud coming from the Mediterranean Sea. You say there's going to be rain. You feel a wind coming in from the desert. You say it's going to be a hot day. Why can't you engage that same thinking capacity to understand the spiritual times? You are clueless. Now, they can't seem to judge between Jesus and the religious leaders at the time. Look at the contrast. The leaders live well, and they put many burdens on the people. Oh, you can't do this on the Sabbath. Oh, you can't do that on the Sabbath. Oh, don't you pay the temple tax? We got to have those 2 shekels temple tax. They collaborate and share power with the Romans who are occupying the country, and from that, they gain political power so that they can rule over most things. And, of course, the common people pay many, many Roman taxes. I saw a list of them one time. You couldn't hardly turn around without some tax being on it, you know. It's like New York State back then. So the temple tax is theirs to spend, and it's a considerable sum of money. Now we look at Jesus. He wanders from place to place. He doesn't put burdens on the people. He doesn't tax the people. He preaches a simple gospel, which they can understand, they can get. And he stands ready to heal the people of sickness and teach and explain to them. The nation had been waiting for a Messiah for centuries. Now he's here. Now this Messiah had been talked about and predicted. Even the Samaritan woman at the well knew. She said, the Messiah is coming. He'll explain everything to us. So as the nation talked about the Messiah, as the nation waited in expectation for the Messiah, he comes. But they don't recognize him. They could recognize a cloud from the ocean or a hot wind from the desert. They couldn't recognize him. The teaching, the signs, the healings, all of his doings are far more clear than a cloud coming from the sea or a hot wind from the desert. They don't get it. And so we ask, could anyone perform more signs than he performed? What more could a Messiah do that he has not done? And so we see the question in verse 57, why don't you take the initiative to judge what's right? Any logical person should be able to compare the ministry of Christ and what the scribes, Pharisees, and priests were doing and come to a conclusion as to who told the truth or who was driven by self-interest. Self-interest, very powerful motivation. And you see it in religious structures to this day. You see it in churches. You see it in priests. You see it in preachers. You see it in various religious institutions. And so there's a certain capacity to drive people toward what is advantageous for the people at the top. That's self-interest. So why mindlessly follow foolish and power-mad leaders into destruction? Why let the religious leaders make your decision for you? Why can't you decide for yourself? Never let anybody decide for you. For if you don't know enough of Scripture to study and think for yourself, you better start studying. Don't wait to be spoon-fed. You don't know what's in that spoon. The next example is going to the magistrate for a judgment. And this is a simple example that the people could understand. It's something they did. While on the way to the magistrate is the golden opportunity to settle the dispute. And the opportunity shouldn't be wasted. Our lives can be seen, all of them, as a long, steady march to judgment. At the end of life, what we've done is going to be judged. And it seems like people often prefer not to make peace with God during that march, during the course of their lives. And they wait and they wait and they wait until life is over and the window of opportunity is closed. It's gone. Now, they have many excuses, including non-belief in God. None of those will be of any help at the judgment. So if you ask what is the acceptable day of salvation, in which we recognize Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God, and we turn to follow him, I will tell you today is the acceptable day of salvation, right now. Today is the day to believe, and you are in no way promised another day, for tomorrow may not come. So as we look at the example given, it's better for people to resolve their own issues than go to a third party. I've seen this myself. You march off to court or you march off to arbitration, and sometimes you get a totally illogical sort of a judgment. And it's particularly true if you're in the wrong. The third party may well make a judgment we find very harsh. So why would you proceed to judgment if you're wrong? If we look back at Deuteronomy 18, verses 18 and 19, God is speaking to Moses there, and we see these words. I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. Nobody knew these writings better than the scribes and Pharisees, the chief priest. They had them by heart. And God is clearly saying that those who will not listen to the prophet sent will answer directly to God. Knowing this, the religious leaders made the choice to reject Jesus. As I think of examples, I had a friend I worked with for a number of years, and I hunted with some, and his dad came over from Germany, and so was bilingual, spoke German and English, and he used to listen to the speeches of Adolf Hitler on the radio in his native German. And my friend remembered his father was always upset after listening to one of those speeches. And he would say, why do they listen to him? He will lead them to disaster. Why don't they see it? Why can't they see it? And of course, that's exactly what happened. He led the nation to disaster. His dad could see it just from listening to the speeches. But the whole nation was deceived. A member of the Pharisees named Nicodemus came to see Jesus. And if we remember what Nicodemus said when he came by night, it's important what he said and what he did not say. He did not say he knew Jesus must have come from God, but he said, Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher. For no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. I want to focus on one word. We. And Nicodemus was in the Sanhedrin. His group, his peers, knew that Jesus came from God. But in spite of that, they were leading the nation to disaster. At that time, the nation of Israel was not accepting their Messiah, and as such, they were marching to judgment. Essentially, they owed a debt. and the debt was increasing, and they were ignoring this ever-mounting debt. They did not want to seek peace with God on the terms that Jesus would supply. And in their case, the judgment would be severe, for the mistakes of the leadership would cause the entire nation to suffer intensely. In fact, due to the fact the siege of Jerusalem, around 70 AD, happened during a festival, a great many Jews from the dispersion were all in the city. They were caught in the city. And they couldn't get out because it was besieged by the Romans. And so the Romans took Jerusalem. Most of the city was knocked down. Only, as I saw when I went there, only the western wall really remains. And people were killed without mercy. During the siege, they crucified people that come out of the city looking for food. Of course, the temple was destroyed and has not been rebuilt to this day. And the nation would be destroyed. Many people were put to the sword. Others were taken away into slavery or fed to the lions in the Colosseum. And so if you look at the religious leaders, they said, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on this way, the Romans will come and take away our place in our nation. Everything that they were fearing, everything they were worried about, happened to them. Their power and authority came to an end. And so the picture here given is that if you don't make peace, the magistrate's going to see to it that you pay everything right to the last cent, all of it. Now, we often learn by examples, and it's a good way. When I was growing up, my dad gave me a good example, and many of his examples I have determined to follow. But you know, the bad example is often more graphic and is longer remembered. Some of the young people I grew up with made some big mistakes, which we don't have time to talk about. But I thought about them, and I determined in my own mind that I was not going to go that way. I was not going to make that particular mistake. Of course, I made other mistakes, but we can't talk about that either. And so, in this text, we are learning opposition is normal, has been predicted long ago. Now, it's in our nature to wish people to like us and to be like us. We're social people. We're social animals. We like to get along if we can. It's nice if people accept the things we do. It's even better if they praise some of the things we do. And so we can be very disappointed when people don't like us and reject the things we say or accuse us of lying or accuse us of being crazy, deluded people that cling to religion. And we are truly surrounded by bad examples on all sides, and the more we look, the more we see. But I tell you, take heed of these bad examples and determine you will not follow them. You're not going to do those things. There's peer pressure when we're in a group to accept the norms and practices of that particular group. But we do have the commands of Scripture, and we do have guidance. And we are also not to expect others to agree and validate our Christian worldview. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because they do not see things the way we see them. Neither are we to accept and validate their customs and values if such things run contrary to the Scriptures. So we might have to say, no, I don't agree with that. I can't buy into that. We have been set apart by believing in Christ. And this means in some cases, we must be content to stay apart. So let us be discerning and on our own initiative judge what is right. If we look at the description of the last days in 2 Timothy chapter 3, where it explains the savage time will come and all the things that people will do, it's easy to see many of these things taking place in our society today. If we look at Israel, it's really a very small country. It should not be of any great significance about the size of New Jersey. But the eyes of all the world are on Israel today. And what happens there can and will have a great effect on our world. War with Israel could easily be the spark that ignites a fire through the whole Middle East. Could even bring in Russia and America. Troops from both countries are there in Syria right now today. Right now today, Iran is threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz to all oil shipping. And so there is all kind of tinder there waiting for the spark. Finally, let none of us rush heedlessly to judgment. Today is the acceptable day of salvation, but not only is it the acceptable day of salvation, it's the day to take care of any amount of unfinished business. All of us have some. Whatever it is, get it done. Make peace with God today while there's time in the acceptable day of salvation. Because I tell you, the future is most uncertain. We'll have our closing hymn now.